With the passage of Public Law 93531 in 1974 and the resulting relocation program, the people's very survival is now being threatened. The passage of the Navajo Hopi Land Settlement Act in 1974 was the culmination of an intense effort by the federal government, the Hopi Tribal Council, and multinational energy interests. At stake was who would control the 1.5 million acre joint use area and the estimated 22 billion tons of low sulfur coal underneath it. In addition to coal, the joint use area contains uranium and other economically valuable minerals.
It was so bad that the first coal contract was made by a Mormon lawyer from Utah who said, told the Hopis, well, of course you're going to need the Hopi Tribal Council. They needed a negotiating agent, himself, of course. And the deal he struck was for a nickel a ton coal.
Oh.
And as it gets even worse, that he took a contingency fee on the contract. It was a $3 million contract, and he took $1 million for himself, which is highly unusual.
The first Trail of the Tears was with the Cherokees back in the last century, but we have one going on right now, and we'll tell you about it on Alternative Views.
We have another sad, depressing story to tell on Alternative Views. People always say, why do you do that? Well, we've got to reflect reality, what's really happening in the world, and so much of it is not very pleasant. Everybody who has grown up in the United States has read history books about the horrible things that the white man has done to the Native Americans. Well, it's still going on. You've read about the Trail of the Tears. Well, they've continued over the years, and we have one that has been impending for a long time out in the western part of the United States. On Alternative Views, we're going to show you a tape slide presentation about what this is, about what is occurring. And we also have Bill Miller with us, an Austinite who actually spent 2 years as an attorney with the Office of the Prosecutor with the Navajos out in New Mexico.
But before we have our interview and our slideshow, here is some extensive economic information which is rather shocking.
Well, we're fortunate to have with us John Cohn, who keeps an eye on such things as the Federal Reserve and what the big banks are up to. You've got some incredible stories here, don't you?
Yes, a somewhat puzzling story when you cast it against the background of the election, the presidential election that we've just been looking at. And thinking in terms of issues that Dukakis could have used to beat George Bush over the head with, and yet he was silent. Here he was on national television, and he had the opportunity to, right there, to confront him with this issue. And officially, the federal government reports a budget deficit of $155 billion for fiscal year 1988. And that's the figure that was used throughout the election. That's the figure that appears in media, the media dutifully reporting the $155 billion deficit. The facts are that the deficit is horrendously larger than that. But to come back to the issue that Dukakis did not raise was this. He charged that if Bush were elected, perhaps he might be prone to reduce Social Security benefits. Of course, this is a very sensitive issue. It strikes a nerve. You get a lot of people excited in a hurry when you talk about reducing Social Security benefits. And so Bush immediately said, no, we would never do that. We are not going to balance the budget or reduce the deficit on the backs of our Social Security recipients. The truth is, they're already doing it. They're doing it to the tune of $100 billion this year. I have the figures from the Congressional Budget Office. What they're doing is they're dipping into the trust fund, the surpluses that are accumulating in these trust funds, siphoning off this money, hundreds of billions of dollars over the next 5 years. They're using that to pay bills. Here are the official figures for 1988. These are official government figures. This is money they've already taken. $39 billion from the Social Security Trust Fund, $16 billion from Medicare, $14 billion from military retirement, $20 billion from civilian retirement, $8 billion from unemployment, and a few smaller figures from other funds. It came to a cool $100 billion for fiscal 1988.
Have they been doing this very long?
Well, apparently since 1984, when the surpluses started building, when they increased, remember, the amount that they take out of the paychecks to go into Social Security. So instead of having a $155 billion deficit, we have a $255 billion deficit this year.
Phenomenal.
It's a little bookkeeping trick, sort of like if a family was a little short and they borrowed some money from, say, a child savings account and put an IOU. Well, the federal government is, in fact, doing just that. They're putting an IOU back in these trust fund accounts in the form of treasury bonds that are interest-bearing, and so it's a loan that has to be repaid with interest just as much if someone external to the government had borrowed that money.
So these are the same. This is the same type of debt as the regular national debt, which mostly foreigners like Japan and Western European governments are buying, and that's what they put in the kitty, these IOUs then.
They leave the notes behind, just very quickly, totals as it builds on out, because it shows the projections. Now, these projections are based on the assumption that the economy doesn't really have a downturn, a serious recession, or worse, but just going on with the entitlements that we know about now, and the projections are that next year they're going to take $116 billion, and then in 1990, $127 billion, and it keeps getting larger year by year, so that the total amount that they're going to siphon off from these various trust funds that I just listed will be $1,395,000,000,000 that will be taken out of those trust funds to pay bills with, and they're leaving IOUs behind. And so George Bush says, we're not going to reduce the deficits on the backs of our Social Security recipients. Folks, they're already doing exactly that, and they plan to continue doing that on out into the future as far as they're projecting.
Not only do they have to pay back this $1 trillion, but they have to pay 10% or so interest on that to get people to buy these bonds. So again, they're just accelerating dramatically the amount of the federal debt, and they're keeping funding it through, you know, robbing these different funds, which either are going to go bankrupt or the whole country is going to become bankrupt trying to pay off all of these debts that are accruing.
Here it is in their official language from the Congressional Budget Office. It says, when collections exceed spending for these programs, such as Social Security and military retirement, the extra funds are lent to the U.S. Treasury. In this way, trust fund surpluses help to hold down the government's borrowing demands. And by that, they mean external borrowing rather than from the internal. So I'd like to put those figures into perspective, because Sam Rayburn used to say, well, you talk about $1 billion here and $1 billion there, and pretty soon you're talking real money. And so when we talk about $100 billion or $1 trillion, these figures seem unreal. But going all the way back, I've checked, these are official government figures again. From the time the United States began, when George Washington was president, all the way up to 1933, which was the height of the Depression, at that time our total debt was $22.5 billion total. For all of that time. We got clear all the way up to John Kennedy in 1962 before our national budget exceeded $100 billion. From George Washington through John Kennedy to get that high. Now, when Ronald Reagan took office, according to the official government figures, the United States was in hock for $914.3 billion. We actually passed the milestone in 1981. We went over $1 trillion in debt, but then we doubled that in just 5 years. And in 1986, we were $2.1 trillion in debt. We're currently, as we sit here, approaching $2.7 trillion in debt. And that doesn't even take into these account these figures that we were talking about, the $1.3 trillion they're taking out of the surplus of these trust funds. And, of course, it does not take into account the money needed to clean up the nuclear waste problem with the weapons plants that are shut down now. That's estimated to cost $150 to $175 billion.
Toxic waste dumps are about the same. Bailing out the banks and the savings and loans, another $100 billion at least.
So this is grim, and again, it brings up the question. I find it very implausible that Dukakis and his people didn't know about these figures, didn't know that they were already raking this money in from Social Security trust funds. They knew it was a very sensitive issue, and they would have gotten a very strong reaction had they made that public, but they chose to remain silent.
And why do you think that's the case?
Well, it could be they didn't want to win this election. You know, it could be that the thought was, you know, the Reagan administration has been living on a credit card for 8 years, has more than doubled the national debt here.
Right.
And so why not let Bush be the guy that's going to be the one when the bills all come due? Let him be in the White House and be the next Herbert Hoover.
Poor George.
Well, you know, I saw an interesting article in the Dallas Times-Herald over the weekend. And it was talking about the insurance companies. We've been hearing about the banks being practically insolvent, so many of them failing. We know that the savings and loan industry, there's been a lot of publicity, a lot of news about the troubles the savings and loan industry have, but I haven't seen anything about the insurance companies. Well, seems like there was a survey of the 15 largest states, their insurance companies. Only 11 of these states reported back their information. And they reported that 131 insurance companies in these states are in receivership. And 73 are in conservation. Now, what that means is that the insurance board is actually directing the operations for the insurance company itself. Now, the 131 that are in receivership, 108 of them were in Texas. By golly, they can't beat Texas. Texas is the best and the biggest of everything. And also 26 of the 73 that are in conservation are Texas insurance. So we've got the insurance companies that are going down the tube. We've got the banks. We've got the SNLs. We've got all this that you're talking about with the debt. I saw or heard a discussion about corporate debt being the highest it's ever been. They don't know how the corporations are going to get out of it and pay it back. And personal debt, individuals, as high as it's ever been. It's scary.
Frank, I have a quick summary on all of that. Because, you know, throughout the election, we're told by the Republican administration that times are better than they've ever been. We're in the longest economic expansion in our history. Here are the facts that I've looked up. Again, these are all based on official government information. In 1987, an all-time record high of $9 billion of rated corporate bonds placed in default. In 1987, an all-time record high in personal recorded bankruptcies. For that same year, an all-time record high American household debt-to-income ratio. 206 bank failures, the highest since the Great Depression of the 30s. More than 500 savings and in loans insolvent. FISLIC, FSLIC, posting a deficit of $13.7 billion at the end of 1987. The total federal budget deficits thus far for the Reagan administration, not counting this year, $1.4 trillion. Our total U.S. trade deficits in the balance of trade, $889 billion in the hole in the past 8 years. The total gross national debt now at $2.7 trillion. So things look pretty grim economically.
And the third largest budget in, third largest item in the federal budget is paying off the interest on this debt.
Which soon will take over the budget. More than 50% of the budget will have to go to financing this debt if these figures continue to accelerate to the extent that they are.
The interesting thing is that this year, their official figure of $155 billion for the deficit is, in fact, the amount of money, approximately, that we're spending on interest this year. And so we're to the point where, okay, as you mentioned, the third largest item in the budget, this money is a drag, a drain on the economy. It doesn't build a highway or repair a bridge. It doesn't pay anyone except, of course,
the banks,
bankers
who are financing this.
We'll have time for a couple of more news stories later in the program. But now let's see what's happening to the Navajos and the Hopis out in the great American Southwest. We'll be talking with Bill Miller, an attorney who's with the Big Mountain Support Group.
Bill, they're trying to relocate several thousand, up to around 15,000 Navajos forcibly in the area that is under dispute. What causes this anyway? Why are they trying to relocate these people?
Well, the origin of this dispute came about when a long time ago the Navajos came on what was originally Hopi land. And the Navajos were forced to either from just natural growth of their numbers to find food and fiber to seek residence on the Hopi territory. Now, the Navajos had a bad reputation in the olden days of being somewhat thieves. And so the Hopis were well aware of this, and they made a deal with the Hopi elders made a deal with the Navajos, and that was, if you live with us in peace and harmony, you can stay on this land. But if you revert to your thieving ways, then you're no longer welcome. And this was, I believe, probably 150 to 200 years ago.
Now, were these actually reservations which were set aside by the white men, or were they the natural and original lands inhabited by them?
Not at this point. They were the natural and original residences of the tribes. Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is that these Navajos who had migrated to the Hopi land lived on that land with the Hopis in peace and harmony in a relationship that was really beneficial to both, because the Navajos were basically shepherds, sheep herders, and cow herders, where the Hopis were farmers, squash, beans, things like that. And so the combination of the Navajo and Hopi really provided for a good diet for both and a mutual protection society.
Were they actually living among each other and intermixing a lot, intermarrying, or were they living separately and were fairly well understood borders?
It would be the former. They did intermarry, and they did live among each other.
Hmm. But they kept their distinctive cultures and religious attitudes and rites and all that.
That's correct. Uh-huh.
Now, we frequently hear the term Diné, and we hear the term Navajo. Now, are these the same people? Because you'll see the Diné tribe is being, or the Diné nation is being transferred. Are these the same people?
Those are the same people. Diné is what we call the Navajo word for themselves. They call in Navajo, the term is Diné. Diné means the people. Mm-hmm. Navajo is an English-sized bastardization of a Spanish word, which allegedly was horse thief.
Oh, anyway. That's where the Navajos got their bad reputation from, being horse thief.
Well, it was recognized in that language, yes.
Well, I guess the most significant thing that happened then was that, lo and behold, these lands became important to the capitalists, wasn't it? They discovered uranium
and coal.
And so naturally they want to move out the indigenous population, just like they've done in the past in the United States, and like they're doing presently in Brazil and the Philippines and other places.
Well, it's even worse than that. What they did was that they set up tribal councils for both the Hopis and the Navajos. Now, these were not the indigenous governing bodies that either had. What they simply were a governmental organization that the United States government could therefore negotiate with. Well, of course, we put in our own people, and as a result, struck sweetheart deals with them. In fact, it was so bad that the first coal contract was made by a Mormon lawyer from Utah, who said, told the Hopis, well, of course, you're going to need the Hopi tribal council. They needed a negotiating agent, himself, of course. And the deal he struck was for a nickel a ton coal.
Oh.
And it gets even worse. He took a contingency fee on the contract. It was a $3 million contract, and he took $1 million for himself. which is highly unusual in contract cases. You usually take contingency. As a lawyer, you would take a contingency in a personal injury case or something like that. But no, he talked the Hopis into the one-third of the contract value for himself.
Well, that ties in then with something which we'll see on the slideshow in a minute, the fact of the immediate reason for the U.S. government coming in to relocate these people. They're saying they can't get along, there's all kind of strife, but in the slideshow they say all this was a fabrication of a public relations firm in Utah. Now, was this lawyer tied in with this? Is this part of an effort?
I'm sure he was, either directly or indirectly. There's been a very sad history of in fact, well, even Mormons dealing with the Navajo and Hopi, and they've certainly taken advantage of those people.
Well, has there been friction then?
Between the Navajo and the Hopi?
Uh-huh.
Well,
that's true.
Not with, again, the any friction that came as a result of these white man-placed tribal councils. Uh-huh. You know, the tribal councils, which were not, in fact, the legitimate governing branch of the tribes, but rather a creation of Washington, so they would have somebody with whom to negotiate. But there were certainly, I know that the PR firm was talking about bullets flying here and there, and that, you know, there was no death, there were no bullets flying to anybody's recollection, unless they were shooting deer or something like that. But they certainly, the Navajos were not shooting Hopi, and Hopis weren't shooting Navajos, any of the information that I found.
Well, let's see this tape slideshow, and then we'll ask you some more questions after it's over with.
All right. Okay.
In our traditional tongue, we have no word for relocation. To relocate means to disappear and never be seen again.
Since the beginning of history, the people, or Diné, as they call themselves, have lived on this sacred land. They have remained in harmony with their environment by practicing a way of life that is as old as time itself. According to the Diné emergent story, the people were given stewardship over the land by the Creator. They were instructed by the Creator to always preserve and protect the natural balance of nature. The people's relationship to this land is an integral part of their religion. In Diné B'ta, there is no separation between religion and existence. Their daily life is a religious expression. Diné religion and culture have survived numerous assaults by white society. Their history and traditions have been passed from generation to generation, ensuring the survival of the Diné people. However, with the passage of Public Law 93531 in 1974 and the resulting relocation program, the people's very survival is now being threatened. This is the Four Corners area, with the Navajo or Diné Reservation in red. The area comprising the blue rectangle was established by the federal government in 1882 as a reservation for the Hopi and all such Indians as designated by the Secretary of Interior. Prior to the issuance of the 1882 executive order, both Diné and Hopi were living on this land. In 1936, the yellow area was established as the exclusive Hopi reservation. Within this area lie the three mesas where the majority of the Hopi live. The rectangular area, primarily inhabited by Diné, had evolved as a shared use area for the Hopi and Diné. The people have peacefully coexisted on this land since before the creation of the United States, solving their differences in a traditional fashion without external interference. The passage of the Navajo-Hopi Land Settlement Act in 1974 was the culmination of an intense effort by the federal government, the Hopi Tribal Council, and multinational energy interests. At stake was who would control the 1.5 million acre joint use area and the estimated 22 billion tons of low sulfur coal underneath it. In addition to coal, the joint use area contains uranium and other economically valuable minerals. Congressional action was based on a belief that a land dispute, or range war, was underway between the Navajos and Hopis living in the joint use area. However, according to a Washington Post expose, the so-called land dispute was a creation of Evans and Associates, a Salt Lake City-based public relations company representing both the Hopi Tribal Council and a consortium of energy corporations. The Land Settlement Act, or Public Law 93531, mandated the partition of the joint use area into exclusive Hopi and Navajo areas. Lands partitioned to the Navajo are shown here in white, while Hopi partitioned lands appear in red. As a result of this Washington-imposed partition, 10 to 15,000 Navajo and 100 Hopi found themselves on the wrong side of the fence, now the targets of a forced relocation program. The traditional people of a joint use area, both Hopi and Diné, deny that this alleged range war ever existed. They cite a long history of peaceful coexistence, including intermarriages and active trading between the two peoples. In the spring of 1986, four young Indian men from the Big Mountain Survival Camp were arrested while confronting a Bureau of Indian Affairs fencing crew. The crew was erecting a barbed wire fence which, if finished, would have desecrated sacred religious sites. Following the arrests, the religious leaders of a sovereign Hopi village of Hotvilla released a statement expressing their support for the actions of the four men. The leaders said, Public Law 93531 was created to divide our land and all original people of this land. It was created without the consultation or consent of the sovereign traditional Hopi leaders and directly violates all teachings and practices of Hopi religion. The federal government, in its drive to move the people, has undertaken a number of coercive measures designed to force people from their homes by destroying their ability to support themselves. These federal measures include a ban on new home construction or repair and a 90% livestock reduction program, which directly threatens the Diné way of life. As the people's means of support has been removed, many Diné have relocated, believing that they have no options other than to surrender or starve. Under Washington's relocation program, Diné people are given three options. One, to relocate to other areas of the already overcrowded Navajo reservation. Two, to relocate to a reservation border town, entering a foreign and alien culture. Or three, to relocate to the so-called new lands, hundreds of miles from the joint use area. These new lands were acquired under the 1980 amendments to Public Law 93531. The new lands are situated in a region that in 1979 was the scene of the worst radioactive spill in U.S. nuclear history. On the morning of July 16, 1979, a tailings pond burst, spilling 90 million gallons of radioactive water and hot solids into the Puerco River Basin. The Puerco River Basin travels through the northern quadrant of the new lands. According to the Diné resistance, all of the federal government's proposals are unacceptable because they require the abandonment of their sacred homeland. Thousands of Diné have chosen to openly resist the relocation program. They have vowed to resist relocation in defense of their religion and this sacred land. According to the Diné, they were placed on this sacred land by the Creator, Meso of Big Mountain.
We were all placed to live in balance with every living being, with everything that was created on Mother Earth. Our forefathers have taught us that we were all placed on this land between the four sacred mountains. All of our sacred songs and prayers are within our four sacred mountains. The teachings of our ancestors are here in our sacred songs and prayers. These songs and prayers are part of the ceremonies. They are our teachings and our way of life. This is our religion. This is what connects us to the land.
The Diné people's survival on this land depends in part on their livestock. Again, made so.
Our Creator has given us livestock as a part of our way of life. From the sheep, we use almost everything. We use the wool for weaving rugs, the skins for bedding, and the meats for our food. The only things that are thrown out are the bones.
Through sheep herding, Diné children learn about the land and the sacred places. Meat from sheep, called mutton, is a central component of a Diné diet. Given the importance of livestock to the survival of a Diné, Washington's stock reduction program can only be viewed as another aspect of the war against the traditional Diné people. Even the devastating impact of the federal government's livestock reduction program has not deterred the traditional Diné from resisting this latest threat to their survival. The Diné people use dry farming techniques to grow corn and other vegetables in their sacred desert homeland. In addition to being a major part of a Diné diet, corn is also used in religious ceremonies. Big Mountain resident Jane Bayaketti.
My mother taught me the value of raising livestock. This is a responsibility that is passed on to us from our forefathers. We must maintain, protect, and carry out this livelihood, even if it has to be a painful struggle at times.
Diné elder Joe Benali.
I was born into a family that only raises livestock. I had raised my family with livestock. The sheep gives us food and wool. The sheep give us joy seeing them in the corral. The sheep sound nice to my ears. I have never had a modern job. I only know livestock.
Since the beginning, the people have survived by practicing the Diné sacred way of life. Five generations of women from the Many Beads family are involved in resisting the relocation program. They live in the Big Mountain region of the Joint Use Area. Within the Many Beads family, the religious teachings of the Diné have been passed from generation to generation. Jenny Many Beads is 102 years old. Her daughter, her granddaughter and her great-granddaughter, and her great-great-granddaughter. Five generations of Diné history. The Many Beads family, along with other Diné families, are currently the lead plaintiffs in a lawsuit that challenges the constitutionality of Washington's relocation program. The suit seeks to have Public Law 93-531 declared unconstitutional as a violation of the First Amendment guarantee of the free exercise of religion. Since the relocation program was first announced, elders from throughout the Joint Use Area have vowed that they will resist this effort to destroy their way of life. Ruth Benali of Big Mountain.
When the time comes, if we don't have any choice, we are going to use our fists. No matter how small I am, I'll fight all the way to the end. They told us to get rid of our livestock. Now they are trying to get rid of us. They are trying to kill us.
Big Mountain Elder Aski Betsy.
But the white man does not understand that we are connected to our land and cannot be treated as parcels to be distributed like the U.S. mail. Even though you have done injustice to us in the past, we were loyal enough to you to have a lot of our own sons fight for you in wars and strengthen your fight to keep this land a free nation. And yet the meaning of free here is in question because we are being denied our rights and wishes to live in harmony as we always have for generations.
Elder Quiche from Big Mountain.
Shady. 저랑 일카리 또 날로스니 삼비라데 네티 또 다지기 I do not like relocation, stock reduction or fencing. Big Mountain is for the people who live here. It holds our prayers. We pray without ceasing for our survival here, not somewhere else. We have no thoughts of relocation.
Pauline Whitesinger of Wide Ruins, west of Big Mountain.
In our traditional tongue, we have no word for relocation. To relocate means to disappear and never be seen again.
Mark Charlie of Tisto, in the southeastern corner of the joint use area.
That the Dineh's sacred homeland consists of sacred mountains, rings, river, animals, and plants. The sacredness was set forth by spiritual prayers and songs, which are preserved within our traditional legends. I cannot abandon these sacred things. That is why I cannot relocate.
But it is not just the elders who are resisting.
B.I.A., you can change me, don't you try. We don't want your wives and rules no more. We can live our own way without
For the Diné people, there is no separation between land, life, and religion. Following the birth of a Diné baby, the umbilical cord is buried, and an offering of the afterbirth is made to a young tree. A cradle board is then fashioned from a nearby tree. These rituals form a spiritual bond between the newborn child and the land. They also introduce the child to the spiritual beings of the area. Coal Mine Mesa medicine man Jack Hitothali.
Our offering places are sacred to us, and the spiritual beings take care of us. We know the land and the spiritual beings here, and they know us. If we would relocate elsewhere, we would not be known by the spiritual beings there, and we could not perform our ceremonies. We would not be able to survive.
The Hogan is the traditional home and a place of ceremony for the Diné, the nexus between the individual, the land, and the entire culture. Mosquito Springs Elder Mei Tso.
A ceremony can only be performed in a Hogan. The Hogan has four main poses which represent the four sacred mountains. The top of the Hogan represents Father Sky. The bottom part is Mother Earth. Between these two are all living beings. In our ceremonies, all of our songs and prayers are within the Hogan.
A Diné Hogan is never abandoned unless it is struck by lightning or a person dies from causes other than old age. A Hogan that is passed down through the family is said to be blessed by the generations. The land is the Diné people's altar. It is their place of worship. Unlike the Judeo-Christian religions, which focus on people or events, American Indian religion, and in particular the Diné religion, focuses on the place where an event occurs. Therefore, the religion is land-based and cannot be practiced at other places. Diné people communicate with the holy people through offering places or altars, which are scattered throughout Diné Bata. Knowledge of these sacred sites are passed from generation to generation. Offering places take many different forms, such as rock formations, buttes, trees, springs, and others. Harriet Wilson of Tisto.
The buttes have been here from the beginning, every one of them a sacred altar. The water, the natural spring, is a way of life as well as life itself. Our songs and prayers, our offerings, are our way of life.
The United States was founded on the principle of religious freedom. However, the Diné people are being denied this basic human right. To forcibly remove a Diné people from this sacred land is to deny them the right to practice their religion, a right guaranteed by the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment of the United States Constitution.
You put me in your boarding school, make me learn your white man rule.
The Diné people are resisting this relocation plan. They have filed a lawsuit in the federal courts seeking the overturn of Public Law 93531. In preparation of the lawsuit, hundreds of meetings have been held throughout the joint use area. The Big Mountain Legal Office has translated and transcribed numerous interviews with traditional Diné elders, young people, and medicine people. These interviews detail the sacred bond between the Diné and this land. The resistance has undertaken this lawsuit in coordination with ongoing political and educational efforts. The time is now to act against this most blatant violation of basic human rights. This genocidal program must be stopped, and it is our responsibility as U.S. citizens. The sovereign Diné people of the joint use area are resisting this so-called relocation plan. To the people, this plan is nothing more than another attempt to destroy them. Big Mountain Elder Nancy Walters.
Judi the nanny linike a yahai Ado lepic it has last day in Hanuko. As the people backed against the wall, we have nothing to renegotiate with because we are now down to nothing but our religion and our lives.
To deny religious freedom for the Diné people is to render meaningless the words, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. On this, the 200th anniversary of the signing of the Constitution, are we as citizens going to idly stand by and watch its protections being stripped away one by one? Is the extinction of an entire culture the price to pay for the insatiable appetite of the multinational energy corporations and the technological future they represent?
In our traditional tongue, we have no word for relocation. To relocate means to disappear and never be seen again.
Well, Bill Miller, this is something that everybody, I'm sure most people feel outraged about. It's kind of typical not only of the way which the white man in North America has treated the Indians or the Native Americans all these years, but also the just gross grabbing of their land and insensitiveness to their culture is outrageous. But I guess this is nothing unusual, is it?
Well, we, you know, the Indians, we always hear the somewhat shibboleth that, that land is sacred to the Indians. But in fact, it really is. It's more than just a saying. The Navajo, for example, when they have a birth of their child, they take the umbilical cord and actually plant it in the ground in their backyard. This ties them both literally and figuratively to the ground. And not only that, but of course the Navajo and the Hopi and most indigenous tribes depend on the earth for their subsistence, whether it be through farming or through being a shepherd or something like this. So land is very much more sacred to the Indians than it is than it ever is to, has been to the white men. We of course have nothing, no comparable cultural practices as the Indians do.
I'm surprised that they base their opposition or base their legal efforts against the U.S. government on religious grounds. I would think that just the mere fact of forcibly relocating around 15,000 people against their will would be against against the law. I mean, certainly it's considered against the law internationally, and the United States always wags its finger when they talk about the Soviets relocating Poles in Poland or the Germans relocating populations. Or why can't they attack this legally from that point of view?
Well, because the United States Congress has first made the determination that that land is Hopi land. So they're not really relocating someone off their land. They're assisting the Hopi Tribal Council in getting the trespassers off their land.
Well, even though people have intermarried and have been living together and among each other.
Yeah, and again, it was completely a congressional determination of what land belonged to which tribe. And it really did not, as you point out, have anything to do with the current practices, land use practices and cultural practices of the two tribes.
Now, this dispute's been going on for many years. We've done a couple of programs on alternative views going back as far as 7 or 8 years ago in which they were talking about this. Why is it still bubbling? Why hasn't it it been settled one way or the other?
Well, the reason, a couple of reasons, but the main reason is that the Navajo simply refused to leave. and the United States and the Hopi tribe are reluctant to use force to remove them. But the Navajos, there are at least 50 families of Navajos say that they will not leave alive. And that just would cause an escalation in violence that neither the United States government, the coal companies, or the Hopi tribe is ready to impose.
What's the present status of it then?
It's in terms of the relocation, it pretty much is in limbo. The Hopi tribe, at least the Hopi Tribal Council, has said that most recently that they really wouldn't mind living with the Navajos who want to stay there. The FBI has said, well, we're not going to take anybody out by force. And the Navajos have responded through the Big Mountain Legal Offense Committee, by at least the Navajos that are living on that land, by filing some lawsuits which are challenging the government's right and the Hopis' right to take them off the land in the first place under, as you indicated earlier, the First Amendment, the free practice of the religion, because they're saying that to be relocated would so contravene their religious rights that that in itself is a violation of the Constitution of the United States.
I don't recall too many cases in the past where the courts have honored this in the case of Indians, though. What chances do they have?
Well, I don't think that this has come to the courts recently, and certainly the other decisions I suspect that I don't know of any cases that have been brought making this claim. But in fact, just recently in the Phoenix Federal District Court, two different judges. One judge granted a temporary restraining order on one suit, which is the Attakai versus the United States, which asked to stop current construction and fence building in a particular area. And the one judge granted the temporary restraining order, and another judge granted a preliminary injunction in the same suit. Now, the temporary restraining order was for 14 days, 7 to 14 days, and now the preliminary injunction has been granted until there's a final hearing on it. But you don't get a temporary restraining order signed or a preliminary injunction granted unless there's a reasonable, very strong possibility that you are going to win on the merits. So from that standpoint, it looks good. But that is just limited to construction and the fence building in this particular area. Now the whole relocation issue is being determined by the United States, or the many beads versus the United States suits, which was originally filed in Washington, D.C., and I believe the government has filed a motion to consolidate those two suits and bring them back to Phoenix. So that's the current status of that. But again, I would think that that there is a reasonably good chance, anyway, that the United States court system would deal fairly and equitably with the tribal claims. And as you point out, it would be one of the first times.
There seems to me something else that's outrageous, and it seems to me to be illegal, and that's the fact that the families who do relocate into a town or something like that and find that they can't, the culture shock is too great, they don't like living there, they will let them go back and live in their original homes.
They will not.
Yeah, that's. I mean, it's like, you know, if I say, well, I'm going to leave Austin, I'm going to go live in Dallas for a while, and then I don't like Dallas, and somebody says, hey, you can't go back to Austin.
That's correct.
That's outrageous. How come that's legal?
Well, again, that's the provisions in the law, and what's even more absurd is
the congressional law that was passed regarding this whole thing?
Yes, 531, which is even more absurd is assume somebody who is all their life lived on the basis of caring for 20 sheep are going to be able to go down to a suburb in Flagstaff where they can't have any sheep at all and live happily. They're simply not equipped. And of course, you know that there is no training, no cultural training, no any sorts of training that would help these people make that transition period.
And a lot of them don't even speak English, I'm sure.
That's true. Especially, and the worst part is the more traditional Navajos, in other words, the Navajos that are more tied to the land, that are more tied to the old ways, do not speak English. And therefore, they would be the ones who are much more deeply affected by this than the younger and the modern Navajos.
Well, this is just another chapter in the outrageous history of the way we've treated American Native Americans all these years. And it's going to be a continuing thing, so if anything new pops up on it, we'll let us know and come back and report to the people on Alternative Views.
I'll be happy to.
Thank you, Bill Miller.
Thank you, Frank.
I see we have time for a couple of more news stories before the end of the program today.
As President Reagan was on the telephone expressing his concern for the three ice-bound gray whales that were the media sensation of October of 1988, at this very time, plans were underway to begin the administration-approved slaughter of over 600 fin and minke whales under the auspices of quote-unquote scientific whaling. Yes, Ronald Reagan has signed a bilateral agreement with Norway, Iceland, and Japan that will allow these countries to kill whales in order to undertake certain unspecified scientific research. According to David Phillips, who's the director of the Earth Island Institute, that this attitude of Reagan's to express concern over three whales trapped in Alaska while the TV cameras are rolling, but allowing over 600 whales to be hunted down and brutally slaughtered while nobody's watching, is simply symptomatic of the hypocrisy of the Reagan administration that Reagan himself has perfected to such a art. At the same time that the media was making all this fuss about these three whales that were captured or that were trapped in the ice, they were completely neglecting the slaughter of the dolphins that has been taking place over the last few years. In 1972, responding to public indignation over the killing of dolphins, Congress passed the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which was a landmark act of legislation aimed at protecting not only dolphins but other marine animals like whales as well. Since its passage, however, more than 1 million dolphins have been slaughtered by the U.S. tuna industry under congressional legislation that has weakened the intent of this original act that allows the tuna companies to slaughter dolphin at the same time that they are catching tuna. This has reached such an extent that the same groups that in the late 60s and early 70s began a boycott of the tuna companies because they were killing off the dolphins and using dolphin meat in the tuna have called for a renewed boycotts, in particular of Ralston Purina that makes chicken of the sea tuna, the Heinz Company, and then Bumblebee tuna. These are the tuna companies that have led the way in the slaughter of the dolphins that various environmental and animal protection groups have called for a boycott of.
Well, we all hear about the war on drugs and don't say no. However, the Surgeon General says there's a drug which is killing 300,000 people per year, and that's good old tobacco. He says that the addiction to nicotine is no different than a drug abuser's addiction to heroin or cocaine or alcohol. As a matter of fact, he said that cigarettes are up to 8 times more addictive than alcohol. So what does the U.S. government does? Well, it says, just say no. You know, we have all these advertisements on just say no. Now, they don't say a thing about cigarettes, though. $331 million each year is poured by the federal government into treatment of alcohol and drug abuse, which is over 25 times the amount estimated of $12 million for smoking cessation. And then the flip side of this is that the government gives the tobacco growers subsidies of over $270 million. At least that's what it was back in 1986. Now, even though $4 billion in Medicare and Medicaid bills are due to smoking-related illnesses, well, what's the medical establishment doing about it? Not a heck of a lot, according to this report, which is the Health Letter, the Public Citizen Health Research Group of November 1988, says that even doctors and hospitals have refused to smoke, to focus on the smoking epidemic. And a recent survey revealing that over one half of all smokers were not even advised by their physicians to quit smoking. So, however, it also says that the consensus is clear that there are certain ways that are very tried and true that can be used so that people can kick the habit of nicotine. Well, who's to blame? According to the newsletter, the neglect lies in many laps. The government's caved into the tobacco industry. Medical schools don't train physicians in methods of smoking cessation. Physicians really don't know very much about these effective techniques, but when they do use them, it helps their patients to quit. Hospitals treat tobacco-caused illnesses, but they do little to help people give up on cigarettes. So, it's a lot more fun to just say no to crack and heroin, but not to the big killer, tobacco.
That brings us to the end of another Alternative Views. We're glad that we could share it with you. We'd like to thank Wendy Nine, who made all the arrangements for bringing the material which we showed you tonight regarding the Native Americans. And we'd like to thank Brian Lynch, our director.
We're appreciative of the people who are involved in the production of the slideshow in defense of sacred lands. The production editors, Corey Dubin and Zach Singer. Narration by El Chao Cunha. And the flute music by R. Carlos Nakai. Additionally, Floyd Westerman was involved in the production, as well as the Other Americas Radio, located in Santa Barbara. And finally, K&L Custom Photographics. Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network. P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. Goodbye.